Greetings, humans. It's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And you may notice a difference from the usual audio quality when I record these intros. That's because it's fucking 99 degrees out, and it's just too damn hot to do anything, so I'm like laying in my bed in front of a fan. I turned the fan off for a second. I had to, but I'm dying over here. So I'm just recording this intro the old-fashioned way, straight to my Mac. What are you going to do? But we have a great show for you today. Our guest is Mark Olmsted. Mark is a poet who's had a long-standing relationship with the most famous beat writers. He was very close with Allen Ginsberg. He wrote a memoir about his relationship with Allen called Don't Hesitate, Knowing Allen Ginsberg, which is available in City Lights. I know they have it, and Amazon, of course. Those cocksuckers have everything. And we talked about his, we talked about all sorts of beat stuff. We talked about Jack Kerouac. We talked about Burroughs. Talked about Corso. And, you know, all sorts of other stuff. But, very important, you should listen towards the end. It's about the 1 hour and 6 minute mark. There's a recording from a couple of decades ago, maybe in the 80s, of Mark's band called The Job, playing a song called Bird Brain with vocals by Allen Ginsberg. So that's pretty great. You better listen to that. If nothing else, you know, I always think people skip this stuff. You could skip it. Whatever. Go ahead. Skip to 1 hour and 6 minutes. I don't care. One other thing I should say, I'm going to take a break for the summer. It's been a lot of work putting these podcasts together. It's been an awful lot of fun. And I'm wondering whether I should still continue doing them weekly. It's really kind of it's really a lot of work. And I have an amazing amount of respect for Mark Maron, who's managed to do 2 of these a week for like 10 years. I don't know how he's managed to do it. So anyway, I'm going to take a break for the summer. And let me know. Write me or whatever. Put a message on our Sensitive Skin Facebook page if you want me to keep doing these. I mean, should I keep doing these? Is anybody that... Hello? Hello? Is anyone there? Let me know. At any rate, here is my conversation. Oh, wait. One other thing I wanted to add. We talked about Mark's dad, who is a relatively famous character actor, but we forgot to mention the most important thing, that he was in the greatest episode of The Twilight Zone of all time, To Serve Man. So if you see, every time you've watched To Serve Man, you'd seen Mark's dad. And oh, we also talked about some very interesting stuff about transcendental meditation that I think you might want to check out. All right. I'm babbling. I'm hot. I want to turn the fan back on. So here, please enjoy my conversation with the most excellent Mark Olmsted.
All right. I'm ready.
Should we start with an om?
How about an ah?
whatever.
We can't even whatever get that together.
You can't even get
whoa,
that shit
how,
right.
What a hopeless bunch you are.
So you said you had a hectic week?
Oh, not particularly. No, just was a hectic moment trying to.
Oh, a hectic
trying
moment.
To, are we actually, is this part of the show here?
Sure, why not?
Just keep them laughing. You
keep
know?
It the first thought, best thought. You know,
first thought, like, best thought. Yes,
yeah,
yes,
I did
yes.
I did a podcast with somebody a couple of weeks ago, and We talked about writing. We were talking about a whole bunch of things. This is the one I did with Rob Robert. We were talking about basketball for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, after about an hour, he said, wait, what? That was it? I said, yeah, man, that was it. He says, oh, I thought we were just like, you know, testing and getting warmed up, you know? I said, no, that was perfect, you know? So
yes, it was perfect. And you could send me the $50,000 to this. Yeah. He'd have never broadcast it.
Yeah. if only. So indeed. Go ahead.
No, I'm looking at your, I see your palatial manor. It looks very interesting. Behind you.
It's a bookcase full of books. I wouldn't call it a palatial manor.
Some frame pictures. I don't know. I have interest.
Yeah, I got some.
Bookcase is very exciting.
Yeah, I got lots of books back there. Yeah.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, they got pictures of J.G. Ballard and Kerouac, and there's a Tonka on the wall there, and you know.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
What a cool guy you are.
Well.
Well, we knew that. As did your audience.
Or is
your
it just?
Audience.
Or am I just a cliche? You know?
No, like I don't think you're a cliche. You know. You're a humble servant, Bernard Meisler.
Oh. So what have you been? What you're in Portland now? You're part of
Oregon.
Part of the Bay Area diaspora, I guess you could call
yes,
it.
Yes, the broken arty expats.
Yeah.
Although it's gentrifying, so. Thankfully, we bought a place because we won't get gentrified out of here too easily.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. When did you move up there? Like 3 years ago?
2 years.
Two years. Okay. And how do you like it up there?
I like it. It's very different. The best part about it is it is slower. It is more relaxed.
Yeah.
And the franticness of the Bay Area, you can't even drive in San Francisco anymore.
It's gotten really crazy. The last half dozen years or so. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's the tech thing, and of course, everything is. It's lost what a lot of us came there for originally.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was such a wonderful place, but so it goes, right?
So it goes. And it's also, I think it's also, it's hardly, I've said this with other people before, it's hardly unique to San Francisco that this is happening.
No.
And there's a lot of reasons for it. I mean, obviously the tech boom, it's not even, I mean, there's always been tech in the Bay Area, but they started moving to the city a number of years ago, right? They put the Google buses and they started busing people basically to the South Bay. Whereas before you had to live in the South Bay if you were working in tech, you know, now they got rid of that commute. But it's also just, there's just a lot more people than there used to be. And there's only so much, you know, room for people to be in. So,
you know. Well, you know, here, my wife Susie and I have been watching, the Chernobyl documentary.
Oh my God!
Back to back with the hot zone Ebola. It's not. They're not documentaries. Docudramas.
You guys are just into lots of fun stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it was like we didn't even like we said they were both really great. I mean, Chernobyl isn't done yet, but we think we can't really recommend these because even though they're really. Completely engaging. It's just too grim. I couldn't think of people that would actually want to see this stuff. It's like everybody's like already kind of stretched to their last nerves, but it was kind of an amazing double bill. Chernobyl and Ebola brought to you.
It feels that way that people are stretched to their last nerve these days, you know?
Oh, definitely.
I started watching Chernobyl too. It's pretty intense.
It's very intense, yeah.
But as far as like the future, talking about, I don't know, what's the solution for global warming? Pretty sure it's airborne Ebola is the solution for.
Well, that's why you should see the hot zone. I know that's. It seems inevitable that there'll be, some incredible breakdown that will wipe out. A huge amount of the population, you know. So, yeah, well, it just seems like we're going there. So
yeah, yeah, and you know? There's a lot of reasons why that could happen. There's the over-reliance on antibiotics. So a lot of the antibiotics people, you know, don't work anymore. And of course, there's air travel. So something could be spread a million times faster than it could have been in the old days. And yeah, you know, well, this is cheery stuff we're talking about.
It's realistic, though. I mean, yeah. Because I do think that, there is in the long run some sort of hope. I do believe there'll be some sort of survival, mm-hmm. And survival of sanity, of basic sanity. But in the short run, I think we are in for it.
Yeah, and I kind of feel the same way. I'm very pessimistic about the short run, but I try to be a little more optimistic about what's going to happen in longer term.
Very optimistic about the long run, but you know, we're talking 300-400 years from now, you know, as the long run.
Yeah.
And the short run, God knows, you know, I seriously wonder, you know, as I'm now 65 and I, you know, get my archives ready and this sort of thing, you kind of say, well, what will survive? Will it survive in even 100 years, even in the best of circumstances? You know, hard to say.
Yeah, hard to
say. Some things will survive. I don't know whether my archives need to survive. You know, more important things need to survive than my yammering.
Yeah, there's an interesting point because, especially if you're talking about the very long term, right?
Yeah.
500 mm-hmm. years or. Or 2,000 years is like his what the things that have survived in that time, was it because they were good or are they good because they are what has survived?
Well, I mean, look at Shakespeare. Obviously, he's great. You know?
Yeah. There could have been somebody who was better than Shakespeare.
Well, that's
at
true.
That time, but, yeah. Whose work didn't get preserved, though.
Well, you know can certainly, I mean? Let's say, as good. I don't know how much better you can get than Shakespeare, but certainly there's bound to be work that is completely lost. Right.
But I guess I'm also saying, if this makes any sense, that Shakespeare is so great because he survived.
Well, I think there's
and
more,
he changed
yeah,
the
I
language, you know
saying.
What I mean? He bent the whole system towards his... language because
well I think he's... I understand what you're saying certainly but he had an insight that survives like Corso. This is interesting because Gregory Corso, the poet, he says you got your three categories. You got talent, you got genius, and you got the divine. And so you say, that guy's got talent. That's good. He says, that guy's got genius. Kerouac, genius. And then you got Shelley. Shelley, divine. And so I would say Shakespeare, divine.
All right. I'll go with that. That's pretty good Corso impersonation there.
Yes. I'm told it is. It's an accurate one. Yes.
Yeah. How well did you know him?
I knew him more through friends because he was scary.
Yeah.
And I was not injecting drugs in my arms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that kind of cut down on my use to him.
Uh-huh. But could you give him, you know, some money from time to time? That was the...
Oh, well, I was never that well off, and I'm not sure I would even want to, like, show money in his presence.
Yeah.
But I think he certainly, at the very least, was a genius. But he was not somebody that I could personally call a friend. I saw a fair amount of him. But, you know, he used to hang around so much in San Francisco and be in the cafes. And, and he lived with a friend of mine, Peter Marti, and who wrote a really great poem about it that's in Beatitude 50th anniversary, something Latif Harris put out with Neely Tchaikovsky. Long poem. I really like that poem. Mm-hmm. Peter Marti, who writes, who has appeared in Sensitive Skin.
Yes.
I like to, I was thinking about that, like, you know, in case you ask me, who do you like these days, you know, young writers and or peers or whatever. And I thought, you know, this is very dangerous. I may leave somebody out and then they'll be mad at me.
For, yeah.
You know, so I thought, like, the safest bet is to say, is to just promote everyone that's appeared in Sensitive Skin.
Yeah.
And say, I like Buddy's Choices for Sensitive Skin. There are a lot of good writers that appear there. And then I could play it safe and say, and I was thinking of them, really. There are a lot of great writers who are basically unknown but that appear. You have good taste. I like,
well,
you know.
Thank you.
You know, I like what you print. I like a lot of the people that you put out. It's a good zine,
all right,
ladies and gentlemen.
So, where I just wanted to ask you, how did you first get involved in the beat scene? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I mostly grew up in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Although, as my wife likes to say, because a good chunk of that was in the Valley, she's, you know, to once more channel Gregory Corso, said, "That's not Los Angeles, you know."
Yeah, come on, that's it is. Los sure Angeles. It is.
Well,
sure
it is. I mean, I thought it was when I was there.
Because your dad was an actor, right?
He was a character actor. Yeah, he actually, you know, it's funny because more and more people are contacting me who are like radio buffs who are from, you know, it's like this word old timey, mm-hmm. It really causes me great mirth. So I use it as much as possible because it's kind of one of those things. It's like the great reveal. It's sort of like annoys or the disconnect, you know, it annoys me just in terms of saying reveal instead of revelation, you know. So you say old timey. So at any rate, it amuses me very much to use a word that I really don't like that's so popular. So I say the old-timey 20th century. Well, ladies and gentlemen, back in the old-timey 20th century, 30s and 40s, we had what was called radio. And my father, that was his heyday, as it turns out. These radio buffs were coming to me. And I really didn't know that much about, you know, I was born in 53. So he was already phasing out of radio, and this was in New York. You know, we lived on Long Island. You know, I was born in Rockville Center in Long Island and grew up in Manhasset, which I remembered very vividly, until about age 6. And by the end of the 50s, live television was dissolving from New York. So we came out to Los Angeles, and he continued as a character actor, but it turned out that his best days were behind him, a lot of which I never even realized, because he had a show literally called Stories by Olmsted, and I went up to something in Seattle where they put on like one of his radio shows, and the guy even imitated my father's way of doing the shtick. They're less interested in his later work than they are in the radio stuff. It's really weird.
Well, radio's making a big comeback, as we are doing right now, sort of quote unquote radio.
Oh,
right?
Yes. Oh, the irony.
Yeah. And it's not just podcasts like these, which are you know, of course ours is, you know, I see these podcasts like the one we're doing, or a dime a dozen. Not that I hope we have more value than that, but there's a million of these podcasts, right? Or just people just talking. But there's also been a resurgence in what are basically radio plays.
Yeah, apparently so.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Of course, you know, my father was, you know, his ultimate god was Orson Welles. And so he really gave me my own love of Orson Welles, you know, which is interesting to share really my father's deep respect for Welles.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, he's my favorite director. But you were talking about the Beats. So, you know, I grew up, my brother was the Bohemian, and he was really around, you know, with a fake ID running around in New York. He was 12 years my senior. And going to bars with a, you know, he's 14 years old and going to bars with a fake ID.
Is he still around? Or
No, he's passed on. Mm-hmm. But he, obviously that was his, you know, that whole, he was a jazz drummer and was actually in, was kicked out of the army for marijuana in 1960.
Wow.
So, and had, turned out, had drug addiction on his record, which he had to have expunged eventually. But he, so he was one influence. He gave me Bukowski for the first time. He gave me Henry Miller. At the same time, my father was reading to me, and of course, his main interest was Poe, and he recorded Edgar Allan Poe on Vanguard Records. So he had some successful vinyl pressings of Poe that I grew up with, and he had a very interesting version of the bells that he would do. Poe's The Bells, you know, where he picked up on bell on the auditory element of the bells, you know, the tintinabulation of the bells, you know.
Oh, yeah. That tintinabulation, there's a word for you.
Yeah, it's in there. You know, Poe really had that auditory sound. And my father also discovered Ray Bradbury, in his first collection, which was called Dark Carnival. And he read some of Bradbury, who came to my father's funeral, actually, and remained a friend of the family's. And Bradbury's, in particular, what interested me, because I was hearing this, my dad was reading me Bradbury, like the Martian Chronicles, and finally I started reading them directly, was the way Bradbury used metaphor. And I really liked this language where you could take an image and link it with another image, and it just kind of blew my mind. So it's a visual element to, you know, language. And that was very much an entry level into the Beats. And in particular, my brother brought home a poem by one of his Venice Beach beatnik pals that was imitating Howl, and I saw it probably at age 13, and I didn't realize that this was imitating Howl. Mm-hmm. It was about New York City, and it had the kind of metaphors like about Moloch, you know, Moloch whose ear is a smoking tomb, you know, this sort of thing that's in Howl was very much in this poem about the subways. And so I was picking up on this, and I'm going, I really like this. And Richard Modiano, who remains a lifelong friend and is now just outside of Venice, where he was for a long time. He's now director in emeritus. Is that how you say it?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, of Beyond Baroque, which has a long tradition of sort of the St. Mark's Place of Los Angeles. It's in Venice. But at any rate, I met him when I was 13, and he was pointing out to me Ginsberg, and said, oh, this is like Allen Ginsberg, you know. And I said, oh, really? And so due to Richard, I started reading Ginsberg and Kerouac and Burroughs. And so that became, you know, kind of obsessive, really, throughout my teen years. And eventually it led to writing Ginsberg, and he wrote back, you know, when I was around 19. And then in a couple of years after that, I met him at a lecture of his teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, a great Lama. And I was very impressed with the Lama, you know, because I was doing transcendental meditation with, you know, which was Maharishi and white robes and giggling.
Where was this? Was this in Naropa or?
Oh, no. You know, where was the lecture? It was actually in Berkeley.
Okay.
By sheer, you know, I'm doing air quotes, coincidence, because it was so profound. But I was going to see a friend of mine who was working in the library at UC Berkeley. And this guy came up to me and said, I'm trying to find this lecture hall. And I said, oh, that's on my way. And I saw he was carrying Trungpa. And I said, oh, you're reading Chogyam Trungpa, you know. And he said, yeah, I'm going to go hear him speak right now. And I said, really? That's amazing. And I said, oh, I wonder if Allen Ginsberg will be there, because I knew he was supposed to be in town. And he said, oh, yes, I saw him. He's going to be there. So, you know, I went up afterwards and introduced myself. And, you know, that began a friendship till the end of his life. Mm. And, of course, the impact of Trungpa was, at age 20, was remarkable because, you know, I was doing this kind of fast food Hinduism transcendental meditation, you know, which has its benefit, but it just sort of, it's sort of like a spiritual Xanax, you know. You know, you just sort of take it and you kind of relax and you go into a trance and you come out and you just kind of hope the trance lasts until the next time you do it. And that was basically the approach. And Maharishi was this giggling, you know, character who seemed, you know, could barely speak English by at least his, the way he presented himself. He actually could speak a little better than that. And I was kind of at the end of, like, being into that because, you know, I was a far more disturbed and dark character than TM was, you know, two spiritual Xanaxes a day were not going to take care of my problems.
Yeah, I was actually just talking about TM with Jenny the other day, and I have a, I don't know, no offense to anybody who practices, but it's, I've never thought that much of it. And I actually heard somewhere that they, and they make you buy your mantra, which I, I heard somewhere, I don't know if this is true, that they give, you know, they say, and you can't tell this to anybody, right? And I heard that they give the same one to everybody.
No, that's not true, actually.
Okay.
I did actually become an initiator. I went and studied with Maharishi and became a teacher of it. Went around lecturing, and I charged money for those mantras. So there was, you know,
you're an apostate.
Not to the extent that I'm going to divulge their methods. But
okay.
There were more than one, and it works to the degree to which going into a trance in a very easy way works. But of course, you know, it's funny because a friend of mine was had me listen to a podcast. He's been listening to all these mindfulness podcasts, and TM tried to get in on it and pitch that they were mindfulness. And I said, you know, I listened to it and I said, this is bullshit. You know, TM is not, it has nothing to do with mindfulness. You know, it's about going into a trance, and you can pitch it philosophically and say, well, it's the essence of mind or the origin of mind, and you're going there and dipping into that, but it's not really.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know. But at any rate, it is not any sort of like bare attention in the moment that mindfulness teaches, the sort of haiku moment. You're doing it with closed eyes, and when you come out, you're sort of blissed out, and I don't know whether you're particularly, you know, maybe you're more aware, but it annoyed me, to say the least.
And were you already writing by this time when you met Ginsberg? Or?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, in fact, interestingly, because I think this keeps coming up, you know, I had been, you know, in high school, they always encourage you as a writer. Right. And, you know, you get creative writing. You say, oh, you're saying this is wonderful. Be a writer. And Then I went to UC Santa Cruz, and I fell in with the writing crowd. It was dominated by, some people know who this is, the surrealist George Hitchcock. And they were all writing like him. And there was no interest in the Beats, although they did have Bukowski come and read there, so that was kind of amazing. We saw Bukowski read in a tiny little room. Yeah.
I wouldn't consider Bukowski a beat, though. I think Bukowski's in his own sort of little universe somehow.
He is he's kind of like a fellow traveler.
Yeah.
He certainly didn't consider himself a beat, and there's a lot of, even though he's frequently included in beat anthologies, there are reasons for him to be accepted in that canon, and there are reasons for him not to be.
Right. Well, I mean, he had this similar sort of viewpoint of society and lifestyle, but I don't know. I always thought of like the Beats as being as much a social group as a writing movement.
I think that's
right?
very true. Yeah, I think that's very true. And in fact, I think Bill Morgan, somewhat, you know, who's one of the great scholars of the Beats, you know, he himself was kind of, he said, well, maybe what amounts to being included in the Beats is that you were a friend of Allen Ginsberg's.
Yeah.
And so that's what you're saying. And there's probably a case for that. Although I think that there are similarities shared by many of the Beat writers. And so you can refer to that. And then, of course, there are those people who say, oh, it continues. You know, it's like the blues, you know, Beat will not die or whatever. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, you really are looking at a cultural niche that, for instance, when the Whitney Museum did their collection of Beat culture, they had an amazing show of art and film and of course, literature. They blocked it as 1950 to 1965. And I think that's very interesting because that makes sense because, of course, even though many of the Beat writers continued writing after 65, it's really turning into something else at this point.
Yeah.
You know?
But, I mean, that also goes back to it being a social movement and social not just in the sense of like you're friends with Ginsberg and right, or et cetera, part of that social circle, but the social movement that was happening in that time. It was almost as if their mission was completed by 1965 when everybody started like, you know, living that sort of life. Not everybody, but a lot. It became almost a mainstream thing by that time.
Well, and then, of course, you know, you have – there's a definite departure with, you know, by the time that LSD is regularly being consumed.
Right, and Ginsberg sort of went up with Leary and
Kerouac
became
a
crazed right-winger and was hanging around with William Buckley and, you know.
Well, I mean, hanging around, he was invited on the show. Yeah. I don't think Buckley had much respect for him.
I think they were actually pretty good friends.
Oh, really? That I didn't know.
Yeah.
But I know that certainly Kerouac espoused some really disturbing right-wing remarks around that period. But most of that I attribute to his advancing alcoholism.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which just basically...
Yeah,
completely fucked him up.
I have a friend who also has the theory that he suffered a severe head injury. Remember, he talks about it in one of the books.
Yeah, and it's like, true.
And that combined with the alcoholism, combined with maybe the massive amount of fame that was thrust upon him, sort of you know, drove him off the deep end a little bit.
There is a theory about the, you know, about where he got beaten up and maybe there was a head injury. Who can say now?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think alcoholism in and of itself, you know, as a being in recovery myself, you know, you really don't have to look very far past just the abuse of alcohol and to find most of the reasons for one's deterioration as a human being.
But it's funny, though, because I also think the fame thing totally ruined him. For me, there's like a real demarcation between like his I think all of his great books were written before On the Road became a sensation, which is also like a 10-year period, right? He wrote On the Road in like 8-9 years before it like came out and was a bestseller.
Well, that's true.
And he wrote Dharma Bums and Subterraneans and a few others in the meantime. And he was just kind of, he was like a guy on the scene. He'd published some, right? He'd published Town in the City, right? He was known in the writing community, right? But he was just like another guy. And then all of a sudden he was, you know, on TV.
Well, there is the truth to that. Although, you know, I think Big Sur is one of his great books. And that was written after he was famous.
I read Dharma Bums again about 5 years ago. And I went into it with some trepidation, right? Because I was, you know, in my younger days, a huge fan. Right. I read everything.
Yes, of course.
Read everything between like the ages of like, I don't know, 18 and 26 or something like that. And, you know.
So how did you find it?
Well, I read Dharma Bums and I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was great. And one of the things that really struck me about it was his generosity of spirit.
Yes, you know, it's true.
Right? There's never an unkind word spoken about anybody in those books.
But you know, I think Dharma Bums is written after, even though it covers the period of around 55, it's written after On the Road becomes successful.
Oh, was it? I thought it was written earlier. Yeah.
No, but you know, he wrote kind of another version of it, which is like the first part of Desolation Angels, which is written before he's famous, or at least a good chunk of it is written before he's famous.
Yeah.
That is in some ways it's a more honest version because he really had a, you know, he really wanted to, turn the wheel of the Dharma by the time, you know, he wrote the Dharma Bums.
Right.
And he didn't really get into the Dharma until the end of 53 or 54. So he inserted some of the Buddhist references in On the Road after he'd written it, because they're not there actually in the scroll.
And it was funny. It's like, and I didn't realize this as I was, as I picked it up. I don't remember what, triggered me to like pick it up all of a sudden and read it. But, I realized that that Gary Snyder's house where they talk about where they have the big party that lasted for like 3 days before he was going to Japan was actually located about 200 yards up the street from where I was living.
Really?
Here. Yeah. It's
so did you actually see it?
Well, the house doesn't exist anymore. It's an open field and it's, and then I found out it's referred to, the locals call it Kerouac Hill.
Oh, how charming.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? Anyway,
well,
then
I'm ever down there. You have to show it to me. Yeah. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah. It's pretty, it's really, it's very interesting. The literary history of Mill Valley, which is, of course, doesn't exist. But I mean, again, around the corner from where I live now is with the house where Sam Shepard lived in the 70s when he was writing all his great plays. And anyway, I after that, I was like, wow, this is great. And I picked up Big Sur and I thought it was terrible.
Did you really?
Yeah, I thought it was just like Drunkalogue.
Well, there is certainly a lot.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, that's true. I can't defend it, but I do think it may be his last book that I really like, because he does write a couple of more, Satori in Paris. Now, that's a horrible book.
Uh-huh. And what was that's Vanity of Deleuze? And
That is also, I actually think that's a really good one, too. That was written in 67.
Uh-huh.
And that I think is also really good. I like that one a lot too. I have to say that's true. Though
I mean, I liked them all the first time I read them. You know,
but, are. You know, Satori in Paris is. You know, it's kind of like reading some of Hunter Thompson's last writing. You know, when he really starts deteriorating.
What was it called? The Great White Shark or something like that.
Yeah, right? Some of the last stuff that Thompson wrote, you go like, oh man.
Yeah.
This is not an advertisement for that lifestyle.
Yeah, you actually see that like like many years of heavy drug and alcohol abuse ends up having a negative effect.
Yes, who knew? You know, I mean, as you and I both know.
Yeah. I've heard, I've seen documentaries on TV about this.
Yes!
Go Ask Alice, I remember seeing that movie.
That's where you got all your
That's where I learned all of, yes.
Yes, of course. You know, it's interesting, like, you know, we see some of these punk shows, that these generic punk shows, and, you know, a lot of people are gone.
Yeah.
And the ones that aren't, pretty much got clean and sober. No one who had any excess, who didn't get out of it, is alive.
Yeah. Well, part of that is also, I think it has to frankly do with like money too, you know, because, you look at Keith Richards still going strong, you know?
Well, you know, it's sort of like, as I remember, you know, you look at certain individuals and they just had, I mean, like, look, Bukowski lived a really, really long time.
Yeah.
But I'm sure a lot of people who followed in his footsteps did not.
Right, exactly.
Well, you know, well, he just had a constitution of some sort of
He had a
ox.
Constitution, but he also, I mean, I remember him talking about in one of his later books about how his, you know, he married his wife and she's like taking care of me and make sure I don't drink more than one bottle of wine a day. And she's going to extend my life 10 years. And
she did.
And you know, I don't know this for a fact about Keith Richards, but I've always sort of assumed that for the last 20, 30 years or so anyway, he's probably had like some sort of like live-in nurse or whatever, you know,
well,
someone there to revive
again,
him,
you know,
or whatever, and as needed basis.
he's his indestructibility skews the survey, right?
Yeah, but I can't remember who I heard saying this. This was like one of the punk guys talking about how, like, yeah, so many of the punks died, but like, look at the fucking Eagles, man. Those guys are all still alive because they had money, you know. But
yeah, I don't know. I mean, look at, you know, I mean, a lot of people money didn't make a difference. Yeah, I think
true.
It really is.
All right. Well, can we, we'll agree that long-term hard drug use is, bad for your kids. Kids,
listen to your elders.
Keep your noses clean and stay in school. Yeah.
Yes, and you could grow up and be like us.
Yeah. Well, we won't want to scare them off after we just reeled them in. So
yes,
well.
Thank God it's only a podcast and they can't actually see us. Right?
Yeah. what did I want to say? So we were talking about Kerouac and the Beats, but you also knew Burroughs pretty well, didn't you?
Well, I met him a number of times, you know, and I made a couple of short movies with him. It's an interesting thing, because again, over the years, it was similar to seeing Bukowski read to this small crowd. You know, in 72, and then by the end, the last time I see him read, he's reading in this gigantic hall, and they're selling T-shirts, and, you know, it was like, I thought, like, wow, this is really amazing, and so...
What was it you think that caused that, you know, from him being sort of like this, sort of, oh, I don't know, almost like niche figure in the Beats, right? I mean, everybody knew about Kerouac and Ginsberg for, you know, for a long time, and it seemed like Burroughs took a much longer time to catch on?
Well, you know, a lot of the punks loved Burroughs,
right,
and really were not all that interested in Kerouac and Ginsberg, because, and they sort of, I think wrongly, equated Burroughs with being, you know, a gentleman junkie, which was also coming in as being very hip.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, you know, for a long time, Burroughs had cleaned up, and then, you know, some of the acolytes in New York City would come visiting, and they were getting him back into it, and that was the main reason that James Grauholtz moved him to Lawrence, Kansas, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to get him away from that influence, because right. that's what people thought you were supposed to do, you know, around him and offer him, and what could be better than shooting up with him. And of course, all this was very much on the DL. I had no idea, mm-hmm. You know, that this was happening. But now, in retrospect, we know that that was true, that they were, certainly there were people around him who, you know, like, there's a story of this one writer, I can't remember his last name, but I met him as the secretary to Burroughs at Naropa in 78. Cabell was dressed in, it was the first person I ever saw dressed in like a classic new wave look. You know, he had the thrift store shirt, the skinny tie. He had like a little button on his shirt.
Yeah.
That didn't say anything. Yeah. It was just a color.
Remember the tuxedo jackets?
Yeah. Well, he was very, no, he was definitely new wave and not punk, you know, mm-hmm. and he had the 50s haircut. And I went like, God, this guy looks really cool. You know, I mean, I'd seen the Mohawk people and the, you know, safety pin people, but I had never seen this kind of guy. Well, anyway, Cabell, I heard a story from this guy who was actually shooting up with Cabell in the bunker, you know, and James Grauholtz coming in and saying, "You can't do that in here." And Cabell says, I'm Burroughs lover. I can do whatever I want, you know. So definitely some confirmation that that was going on around Bill, and I imagine.
Yeah, but it is interesting, like you said, that he was picked up by the punks, right? And there was the famous Research magazine.
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah, absolutely.
I think did a lot to, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
Bring about a resurgence in interest in his work, I think.
Yeah, I really was interested in him, you know, already, you know, I really liked, even in high school, I was reading, you know, Naked Lunch, and I still thought I was a hippie. Uh-huh. That would be, you know, the 1970 or something like that. But probably that was the influence of my more literary friends like Richard Modiano saying, uh-huh. you know, this man, William Burroughs, is also significant. And of course, as you get into the whole mythos of Kerouac, you know, you see which characters are which, you know, and Burroughs shows up a lot, you know, Bully and this sort of thing.
Sure. It's funny, I hadn't thought about it for a while, but I discovered him like my freshman year at college. And mm-hmm. So this was 1978. And he was being taught at the college. I can't remember what mm-hmm. the course was, but mm-hmm. I remember I read Naked Lunch in a kind of in a cut up way. I was just wandering around different dorm rooms, and everybody mm-hmm. had a copy of it, and I just like, pick it up and continue from where I left off and read like 10 more pages, and then, you know, that's how I read
it. Well, makes sense. Yeah, I mean, it is randomly assembled. I mean, that's always been the story. There are routines that he was writing down largely to get Allen Ginsberg back in his life, you know, mm-hmm. which, you know, he...
Oh, is that true? I didn't know
he was in love. He was in love with Ginsberg. And in fact, this shows up in Desolation Angels, which is one of the better parts of the book, where Kerouac goes to Tangier and visits Burroughs. And Burroughs is, you know, he helps Burroughs type up some of the manuscript for Naked Lunch mm-hmm. and has nightmares of bologna sausages coming out of his own mouth.
Well, I mean, what's the story is that, that, you know, Burroughs wrote those first two books, which are, mm-hmm. you know, almost like pulp novels, right?
I'm thinking Junkie and Queer. I mean, first there's Junkie and then
there's Queer.
And then Queer.
Yeah.
Queer, of course, came out much later.
Yeah. But
they
were originally...
Well, they're like Dashiell Hammett, basically. Yeah, that was his huge influence.
Right. But they're like short novels that are with...
Yeah,
classic narrative structure.
Whatever. Yeah, definitely.
And then he went off to was it Tangier or Morocco?
Yeah.
And
and
was just getting high, living off his inheritance, I guess, his trust fund,
which was supposed to not be very much. He's
but
always
probably
said,
went, probably in the 50s in Tangier. It probably went, you know, probably
he could get by, obviously.
But at any rate, he had I had heard that he wrote 10,000 pages of this stuff, and Kerouac came and said, okay, here's like, you know, a really good 250 or whatever. And then it was apparent. And then I think it was Corso who went around and got it published. He was the one who,
no, I think it's Ginsberg. Don't think Corso.
I meant Ginsberg.
Ginsberg went around and, interestingly, Ferlinghetti turned it down.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. He turned down Mexico City Blues too by Kerouac, which is another one of his great ones. Yeah. That's kind of like, interesting, but not exactly a claim to fame that you turn these things down. But I think he was kind of appalled by Burroughs, as a lot of people were, you know, reading this stuff. But, you know, Burroughs had first started doing his routines. You know, he would get high, and Kerouac and Ginsberg would be over on the sofa, and he would suddenly come out and, you know, be in drag and start camping up and running around with a machete and shit like this. And they had never seen anything like it. And of course he was hysterically funny. And then he started writing them down in letters to Ginsberg, because he thought Ginsberg would like these things.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them are like comedy routines, you know,
they're very funny.
Yeah. Like the Dr. Benway thing. Doing on Saturday Night Live. Like,
I know. Yeah. With Lauren Hutton.
Yeah.
Introducing.
There you go.
I'm not sure we would see that kind of thing anymore. I know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think times have changed, unfortunately.
Well, could we even see a character like Burroughs anymore?
There's bound to be, you know. I mean, this is one of the things that's so interesting about being a writer now and trying to get sort of message out as we see well from your own, you know, who you publish. There's a lot of really interesting people, but you know, you've published Vincent San Grillo, you know, we both admire quite a bit. You know, that's a great voice, but I don't think that the times really are particularly interested in that. I think that, unfortunately, after everyone's dead, they may, if the material still exists on the planet, somebody may rediscover it.
I guess this is something I've thought about before, but and I don't mean this to sound depressing, because things are just different. But I think about like people who died in the 90s, people who left the planet around the 90s, or whatever. And in a sense, the world has become so homogenized that it wouldn't be possible for people like that people like that just don't exist anymore. I'm trying to think of somebody, for instance, who's, you know, say 50 years old now, 50, 60 years old, who's the equivalent of like Burroughs or Sun Ra or Johnny Cash. You know what I'm saying? It's just like there's just kind of no room for people like that. You know, maybe you had like a Kurt Cobain kind of character, but I don't know. I think there's like a lot of behavior that it's funny. It's a two-sided coin. It was like at one point it was so shocking that it put you into this other world where, you know, and at the same time, so much of that is like acceptable now, almost. You can see it like on fucking HBO. but at the same time, so much of it is just like not allowed anymore. Right. Like I think of the whole idea of like the junkie rock musician, you know, it's like people don't want to know about that shit anymore.
It's interesting. I do think that there must be these various amazing people. I meet amazing young people doing amazing things musically and
artistically. It's not a matter of talent or genius.
It is not. It's not bankable.
Right. Right.
That's really what it is.
So I guess that's what I'm saying, that there's not room for people like that to go into the mainstream as they used to be.
It's not bankable. And there is an attitude, you know, unfortunately we are back into a kind of attitude. There was a, in fact, I was on a panel at Beyond Baroque, and there was a young gay poet, and we asked him, you know, I mean, among other things, asked him, has William Burroughs influenced your work? And he said, he shot his wife and basically dismissed him. I was with Steve Silverman and Tate Swindell. Yeah, who's a really interesting beat scholar. But we were kind of, we didn't know what to say, you know. And we that led to a whole discussion of people like Pound and, you know, Pound did some really terrible, said some really terrible things.
Yes, he did.
And yet we're still reading him.
Right.
Well, or some of us are. Yeah. I think he's a great poet, but and he did eventually admit that he was wrong.
Yeah, but so, but I mean, maybe that's the point that you just sort of struck upon, is that people used to be able to, I don't know, I don't want to paint with such a broad brush, but yeah. And now, of course, I've lost my train of thought completely.
Well, we were talking about a kind of, I think there's a more unforgiving, dismissive element right now. Although I don't know how you can really do that, because it is always assumes that you mean you don't have some remark that you made, some skeleton in your closet.
Yes, yes. Okay, no, that's what we're...
Can anyone actually say that? I have so many things I'm embarrassed that I've said and done. I know that, you know, they would bite my ass I were in the position for anyone to give a shit.
Absolutely. No, but I guess what I was saying is that we used to seem like make better excuses for people like Pound or Celine or Picasso, right? And
well,
now
it goes
we're
on
sort
and
of
on,
yeah, it goes know? On and on. And now it seems like I don't know. There was that what was her name, Hannah something, who did the whole thing about Picasso. No, he was horrible, you know. And I feel like people are not able to separate those things, you know, to put like the behavior in a separate box from the
the
art
and
anymore.
That'll probably change. You know? I just think it's a you know, it's just a sort of reaction right now.
Yeah,
that's going on, and everyone being accountable and saying, "Hey, look, you know," and the intensity of that, like, "Oh, we're going to like boycott this person now because he," you know, I mean, imagine. Well, you could say, okay, I'm going to boycott Pound because, you know, we don't even need to list his sins. They were terrible, you know, he's anti-Semitic for sure. And then, of course, he was, you know, pro-Mussolini and, you know, it's just ridiculous, you know, all the stuff he did. But, you know, we're not going to go Maoist, and I should hope not, and, you know, burn his books and make him erase him from history because of that.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, for instance, the thing about Shakespeare and the Merchant of Venice, you know, and the very little, you can't really look at the Merchant of Venice as not being anti-Semitic, really.
But Pound, beyond being anti-Semitic, didn't he actually have like a pro-Nazi radio show? And
he had a pro-fascist radio show. Yeah. I think you know he.
So it wasn't just like he said some stuff, right? He actually.
Oh no! You know, yeah, he was really bad. Yeah. I mean, he came back and they put him in a cage.
Right, right.
He doesn't.
Yeah,
And then
he didn't get put in that cage for no reason, right?
No, he did not get put in that cage for no reason.
Yeah.
Although putting him in a cage, I don't know. He was. There's no apology. For that guy.
Yeah. No.
In that regard. But what a great poet. What an astounding poet.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
I know. Well, that's sort of kind of like what we're talking about in general, which is like, well, we now put certain people into this box where we say, this person is a monster. We are not monsters. This person is a monster. He should remain in the monster box for time immemorial, and all of his work never played again.
Yeah,
you know, there is a kind of view of that. And
I know. I don't really.
Things are way too complicated.
Things are way too complicated. And aren't we all monsters after all?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, certainly from the Buddhist view of any sort of reincarnation. We've done it all.
We keep coming back for a reason, right?
Well, we've done it. We've done it all, basically. We've been the predator. We've been the victim. We've been everything.
Right.
We've tortured. We've been tortured, which is a kind of a shocker, I think, for a lot of people. Say, no, that's not the case. But we see it enough, even in current politics. You see the behavior of. We won't go there either. But a victim going and becoming self-righteous, and then perpetrating further crimes against other people.
Well, that's the whole wheel, which
indeed the whole wheel,
which Khaleesi said she was going to break, and she didn't. Yeah. on that note, do you want to read something for us now?
Yes. I'm going to read a couple of short things. First of all, something right out of the fabulous Sensitive Skin. So I'll just read this part, and then I'll read another 80s part from a book of mine, and that will be it, huh? This is called Head Without a Body. I can't remember when I first met Vinny, but by first memory, he was using heroin, as was Mark F., and now Peter. It was basically an East Coast thing that was kept very on the DL out in the Wild West, so I never saw these guys use, and in fact, in all the time I knew Vinny up to his quitting, I never once saw him shoot up. Somehow these guys had all met at Naropa 1977, and they'd snuggled up with Corso, and though Gregory had never given anyone their first shot, he had that Bird Parker vibe that was super cool and maybe a source of genius to these guys anyway. He was too scary for me. So as the 80s loomed in, they were all shooting themselves up, except Peter, who still needed help, but they knew it was very bad karma to introduce anyone to it, so they kept it from me. Close as I came to begging for it out in NYC, I never did stick a needle in my arm. Vinny was ultra cool with his New York Italian accent, and he really had a laid-back, junky, mafioso vibe like Mickey Rourke in Rumblefish. And in fact, Vinny had sold to Willem Dafoe when Rourke was in the room, and I asked Vinny if Rourke also dabbled, and Vinny said he didn't see him use, but where there's smoke, there's fire. Add to this his stepping out of Peter's shower in a huge billow of steam, and Christ, what a wang on this guy. I mean, it was hard not to be impressed. But Vinny would come out to San Francisco to be in a healthier way, or something like that, to pretend that, at least. He once explained, New York is a head without a body. California is a body without a head. We thought he was being pure when we all took mushrooms and went to the beach, and by now Peter and I were pretty much established in our alcoholism and Hunter Thompson's style of tripping, which meant taking the edge off those really nasty dark corners like, did my parents really love me? Booze certainly helped, though it cut down on any spiritual aspect and just turned it into a gonzo holiday of challenging sanity itself. I was already doing Buddhist sitting and meddling in the occult sciences, Miller, see the Karloff mummy for that quote, but sobriety for all of us was years away. So Peter and I sucked at 40s of beers and pranked around on the beach, having tug of war with seaweed while Vinny went into the water or sat on a rock and said nothing. It brought back my own confusion about the rabid interest of the Grateful Dead that really remains a part of San Francisco to this day. I never understood it. Vinny did, listening out in NYC as a teen. The idea of doing acid and listening to them seemed like an outtake from The Time Machine, where all of a sudden the siren sounds and all the flower children march into the big Sphinx and go down and get eaten by the Morlock cannibals. But you can dig why I liked punk rock and early new wave, the second really being what's now called synth punk and not all that horrible Duran Duran stuff to follow. The hippies had failed me. Punk in general disdained them, which is funny now since Burning Man is some big amalgam of everything that came before, electronica, hippies, punk, new wave, occult, piercings all thrown into the same laundromat dryer, so you could see the mismatched clothes thrash about in the porthole. So Vinny admitted he liked the Grateful Dead, and it looked like he was having a Grateful Dead Tim Leary moment. Later, he told me he'd shot up earlier. The end. Okay, so here's the other one.
Okay.
Yeah. The other one is talking about my... well, it'll make itself clear. It's another 80s story. And then, as I understand it, you will play at the very end the live cut of this very song that I mentioned in here.
Okay.
With Ginsberg. But so this will be it, and then you'll hear Ginsberg doing Bird Brain with the band The Job. So anyway, this is the back story to that. In San Francisco, this is from Don't Hesitate Knowing Allen Ginsberg. This is actually published, one of the few things that I actually have in print. You can get it on Amazon.com, kids. But it's based around correspondence with Ginsberg from 72 through 97, letters and recollections. But at any rate, here we go. In San Francisco, November 81, Ginsberg was going to read at On Broadway at North Beach, directly above the legendary punk club Mabuhay Gardens, and invited my new wave band, The Job, to back him up. Gregory Corso was also on the bill. Bob Kaufman, the black poet of the North Beach Bar Dagon poem recitation of my first date with Allen some years prior, had come along with Gregory. Kaufman shuffled about like an electric shock casualty, barely speaking. Kaufman was badly beaten by the police years earlier and may have suffered some brain damage as a result. By all accounts, he was functioning normal until that police roused. We met backstage and Corso was cantankerous. "You young rock and rollers are just in it for the gold." I thought to myself, if we are, I've yet to see it. I was splitting $90 between five band members, and that was more money than we usually saw. He thought my friend Paul Stiver was a Rolling Stone magazine schmuck. As we stood backstage with the girl interviewer who shrank into the corner during this tirade, I worried that Gregory might do anything, wander on stage, disrupt the band, etc. Allen agreed that this could very well happen with Gregory, but it would be all right. I only half got this crazy wisdom teaching, but I accepted it, and Gregory behaved himself. Special thanks to Richard Modiano's journal in getting the details of this memory correct. Allen told the band last minute that we could go on after his reading and play a few songs. I had gotten completely soused, as opposed to functionally soused, thinking I was done for the night. On top of that, the drummer had wandered away, clearly bored with the poetry. He was found downstairs in the mab. At one point, I was rushing down those stairs to run into Michael McClure walking up, and he paid me a compliment about the band, and I thanked him, but told him I had to find the drummer pronto. McClure frowned that I didn't stop to chat. I had apparently fucked up with him yet again. When we opened with a song, I was so drunk that I forgot the lyrics. I could only make up phonetic noises with vowels and consonants. No one noticed. After Allen and Gregory left, the energy of the remaining mob was barely containable anyway. We did three or four songs and stopped. While Richard watched the pre-show with Paul and the show itself and the final aftermath, Paul told him this would make a great Robert Altman film. And now, Bird Brain by The Job with Allen Ginsberg.
Bird brain runs the world. Bird brain is the ultimate product of capitalism. Bird brain, chief bureaucrat of Russia, yawning. Bird Brain ran the FBI 30 years, appointed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in an effort to chase Cosa Nostra. Bird Brain apportions wheat to be burned, keep prices up on the world market. Bird Brain lends money to developing nation police states through the World Bank. Bird Brain never gets laid on his own. He depends on his office to pimp for him. Bird Brain offers brain transplants in Switzerland. Bird Brain wakes up in the middle of the night and arranges his sheets. I am Bird Brain. I rule Russia, Yugoslavia, England, Poland, Argentina, United States, El Salvador. Bird Brain multiplies in China. Bird Brain inhabits Stalin's corpse inside the Kremlin wall. Bird Brain dictates petrochemical agriculture in Afric desert regions. Bird Brain lowers North California's water table for Orange County agribusiness banks. Bird Brain harpoons whales and chews blubber in the tropics. Bird Brain clubs baby harp seals and wears their coats to Paris. The Pentagon. His brother runs the CIA. Fat ass bucks. Bird Brain writes and edits Time, Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, City Lights, San Francisco Examiner. Bird Brain is Pope, Premier, President, Commissar, Chairman, Senator. Bird Brain voted Reagan President of the United States. Bird Brain prepares Wonder Bread with refined white flour. Bird Brain sold slaves, sugar, tobacco, alcohol. Bird Brain sent 20 million intellectuals and Jews to Siberia. 15 million never got back to the Stray Dog Cafe. Bird Brain wore a mustache and ran Germany on amphetamines the last years of World War II. Bird Brain conceived the final solution to the Jewish problem of Europe. Bird Brain carried it out in gas chambers. Bird Brain manufactured guns in the Holy Land and sold them to white boys in South Africa. Bird Brain supplied helicopters to Central American generals to kill a lot of restless Indians. He wanted to encourage a favorable business climate. Bird Brain began a war of terror against Israeli Jews. Bird Brain sent Zionist planes to shoot Palestinian huts over Beirut. Bird Brain outlawed opiates on the world market. Bird Brain formed the black market in opium. Bird Brain's father shot Skag in the hallways of the Lower East Side. Bird Brain organized Operation Condor to spray poison fumes on the marijuana fields of Sonora. Bird Brain got sick in Harvard Square from smoking Mexican grass. In Europe to conquer cockroaches with propaganda. Bird Brain became a great international poet and went around the world praising the glories of Bird Brain. Bird Brain isn't evil, he just don't talk good, he's sympathetic. I declare Bird Brain victor in the poetry contest. He built the World Trade Center in New York Harbor without regard when the toilets emptied. Bird Brain in Iraq attacked Bird Brain in Iran. Bird Brain in in Belfast, throat bombed at his mother's ass. Bird brain began jumping down the Amazon rainforest to build a wood pulp factory on the Amazon riverbank. Bird brain invented the theory of relativity so that the Rockwell Corporation could build neutron bombs in Rocky Flats, Colorado. Bird brain's gonna see how long he can go without coming. Bird brain thinks his dong will grow big that way. Bird brain became a Buddha by meditating. Bird brain found out he was a Buddha by meditating. Bird brain's afraid he's gonna blow up the planet, so he built this rocket to get away.
All right, man,
that was great. It's good talking to you.
Good talking to you. Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure.
Good luck.